Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. My name is Ross Peterson, one of the co-editors of that journal. We're especially privileged today to have Professor John Sillitoe with us. John's an assistant professor at Weber State University and director of their Special Collections and Archives. He's a native of Salt Lake City, Utah, has advanced training in history, has written many, many things about socialists in Utah with a co-author, John McCormick, and has recently edited two books, Wilderness and Faith and Letters in Exile, both of them published by Signature Books. Today, John will be discussing Enigmatic Apostle, the case of Richard R. Lyman. So we'll introduce John Sillitoe.
On Friday, November 12, 1943, a small notice appeared in the Deseret News saying that by his own admission, Apostle Richard R. Lyman had been excommunicated from the LDS Church for violation of the Christian law of chastity by order of the Council of the Twelve Apostles. The news of this action spread quickly by word of mouth and, as one might assume, had a dramatic impact on the church membership. Lyman was a popular figure in the church hierarchy, especially with young people and some of the intelligentsia. As we approach the 50th anniversary of this action, the events surrounding the excommunication, the repercussions it had in the church, and indeed the very career of Richard R. Lyman as a general authority, are still obscure. In this paper, I propose to do three things. First, briefly examine Lyman's early years and career after being called to the Council of the Twelve in 1917. Second, deal with the events surrounding the excommunication itself. And finally, address some of the questions Lyman's case raises in terms of the selection of church leaders and the implications for the Mormon hierarchy, when there is a breach of accepted behavior. Richard R. Lyman was born in Fillmore, Utah on November 23, 1870. The son of a famous Mormon family, Lyman's grandfather, Amasa, was an early apostle and a confidant of the prophet Joseph Smith. His father, Francis M. Lyman, also held the office of apostle and was an important figure in the church hierarchy in the period from the Woodruff Manifesto to World War I. Richard graduated from Brigham Young Academy in 1891 and obtained a master's degree in civil engineering at the University of Michigan 4 years later. Before his call to the Council of the Twelve, Lyman enjoyed a distinguished career as a civil engineer and educator. An active academician, Lyman joined the faculty of the University of Utah in 1903, where he was prominent in scholarly circles, the recipient of numerous awards and honors, and the author of several monographs and articles. His engineering skills led to his involvement with three of the seven modern civil engineering wonders of the world: the Sanitary District of Chicago, the Grand Coulee Dam, and the Los Angeles Metropolitan Water System, a fact that Lyman was particularly proud of. In addition to his career in education and engineering, Lyman was active in business and owned an automobile company in Salt Lake City. During these years, Lyman's church activity consisted primarily of service on the ward and stake level. And over the years, he served as a young men's counselor and superintendent in both the Utah and Salt Lake stakes. Lyman married Amy Brown on September 9, 1896, in the Salt Lake Temple. Both Amy and Richard had been popular students at the academy. As befitted their status within the church aristocracy, both coming from prominent families, the marriage was performed by Joseph F. Smith, then an apostle and counselor in the First Presidency, and of course later president of the church. And it appears from all evidence that the Lyman's marriage was fairly typical of the pattern of the times. During the early years of their married life, Richard pursued his academic career while Amy was active in the Relief Society, serving first as secretary treasurer and then later as general president. As a professor at the university, Richard, a tall, handsome man, cut a striking figure on campus and in the community as well. Both of the Lymans made their mark on their times, especially after each entered the church leadership ranks. Amy, for example, had a tremendous influence on women's and social welfare programs within the church. After his call to the Council of the Twelve, Richard served in a number of capacities, including the presidency of the Mutual Improvement Association and as president of the European Mission in the late 1930s. Lyman's work as a member of the Council of the Twelve came to an abrupt end with his excommunication in 1943. After publication of the announcement in the Deseret News that I read, very little information was published in the local press about the nature of the Lyman case. Outside of the state, however, several newspapers examined the action in sensationalized accounts. Typical is the following, which was published in the New York Mirror's Sunday magazine. I'm going to read at some length. I hope you'll allow me to. It's kind of long, but it's kind of interesting just the way the article was written. I'm quoting now. Elder Lyman has been branded a sex Judas for being caught by his colleagues in dereliction with a pretty young stenographer. That's what the town's whispering. At this stage of the Lyman case, neither Mrs. Lyman nor the world at large has been informed of the Star Chamber evidence on which the 12th apostle of the Mormon hierarchy confessed and was found guilty of unchastity by his peers. Did he seduce a neighbor's daughter, a colleague's wife, or did he commit a more vulgar, commercialized infraction of the moral code? The synod doesn't say. In fact, the blasting decree published by the all-powerful Mormon body in Salt Lake City's church-owned newspaper did not go beyond the stiff official announcement in a two-column box at the left-hand corner of page one. Lack of detail in the notice of excommunication of St. Lyman upon his own confession has set the people guessing in the beautiful Temple Mountain Girth town, which is the fortress of the Mormon faith. Since the mid-November date of the excommunication, Mormon and nonconformist news gatherers have besieged church officials for further details. Telephone lines into the headquarters of the Latter-day Saints in the Mormon temple enclosure have been choked with calls from initiates and outsiders, arguing for the public's right to know the answer to the key question, who is the girl? It is reported that church authorities have cracked down among the inquirers who are members of the sect, reproving them for curiosity injurious to the church. The inquiries at the temple have tapered off. The focus of public pressure for information has been transferred to the magnificent Lyman Estate in Salt Lake City's finest residential quarter. Speculation now centers on the possibility that ex-prophet Lyman's sole wife may seek divorce and on the nature of the evidence she would have to bring in that event before a court which operates under legal, not Mormon, rules. Obviously, most of the information in this published report is inaccurate. As I say, it's mostly interesting because of the lurid nature of the reporting itself. Let me continue for a minute. The story goes that the partner in Lyman's sin was a stenographer, occasionally employed in the church office building, where ex-prophet Lyman used to have his suite of apostolic offices. According to this version of what went on, when Lyman broke down and confessed his sin to his colleagues in the College of the Latter-day Saints, he was confronted by the girl's mother, who in substance made the following charge. My daughter has been forced to come to me with the confession that she expects to have a child by this 72-year-old grandfather, whom she was brought up to venerate as a chosen vicar of heaven. Unless this Council of Twelve casts out this offender, I shall be forced to go to the secular courts of Utah to seek justice for my daughter, security for her expected child, and punishment for the seducer. The account further notes that Lyman's admission of guilt sent his peers into closed session in the famous quorum room, the sanctum sanctorum of the temple. After consultation, the article notes, the apostles emerged with the decision to expel sinner Lyman from communion, a verdict which carries with it eternal denial of Lyman's hopes of ever entering Mormon heaven. Of course, anyone familiar at all with LDS history or terminology knows that the writer of this article knew very little about either one. No one refers to the Council of the Twelve as the College of the Latter-day Saints. Excommunication is never referred to as expulsion from communion, at least I'm not familiar with it. At best, a few basic facts are contained in the article, but very little else of the account is at all accurate. At the same time, after more than nearly 50 years, little is really known within the church or without of the Lyman case. What we do know is simply this. On Thursday, November 11, 1943, Lyman was found in bed with a woman who was not his wife by Apostles Harold B. Lee and Joseph Fielding Smith and several police officers who forcibly entered the woman's apartment. Earlier that day, Lyman attended the weekly meeting of the Council of the Twelve Apostles in the temple. The woman in question had known Lyman for more than 20 years. Theirs was a long-term relationship. Both were in their early 70s. She was not a young stenographer and definitely not his secretary. Lyman met the woman in the 1920s after she had been excommunicated from the church because she was a plural wife. The woman protested to the Council of the Twelve that she had not known her husband had other wives prior to the time she married him, and wouldn't have done so if she'd known, and asked that the Twelve investigate her case. Lyman was assigned the task and reported that he believed the woman was telling the truth and should be rebaptized. This was the beginning of a relationship that would endure for nearly 30 years and would, in fact, continue after the excommunication itself. Most of the primary information we have concerning Lyman's excommunication is found in the diaries of George Albert Smith and George F. Richards, in the biography of Spencer W. Kimball, and in various recent autobiographies of church leaders like Harold B. Lee and Mark E. Peterson. From these sources, we can recount the following basic facts. On November 9, 1943, George Albert Smith recorded that Lyman's case was called to his attention and that he was shocked. The next day, he notes that the case was still on his mind and that he prayed that the charges were unfounded. Smith further records that Joseph Fielding Smith and Harold B. Lee had been given the assignment to examine the case and that they had called at his home, Smith's home, to report their findings. On Friday, 10 of the members of the 12, including Lyman, were in attendance for the excommunication. The only two missing apostles were Elders Charles Callis and Ezra Taft Benson, who were out of the state. At that time, Lyman admitted the charges against him, said they were true, and made no defense of his actions. Additionally, George Albert Smith reports that Lyman admitted more than had been known before, and that he, Smith, was shocked because Richard R. seemed not to realize his wrong. Smith concludes his journal account saying that all of the brethren were in tears. We excommunicated Richard R. We decided to just put a notice in the news that the devil has surely done his worst. The next day, Smith visited the Lymans at their home at 1084 3rd Avenue. In his diary, he indicates that this is a sad day. The news has spread like wildfire. Amy is prostrated. Richard R. seems in a dream. 2 weeks later, Lyman still seemed to be in this daze, since Smith records, quote, stopped at RRL's home and talked to Amy and Richard. She is crushed. He seems in a dream. Another detailed firsthand account of these events comes from the diary of George F. Richards. Brother Joseph Fielding Smith phoned, saying that the meeting of the 12 called in the temple was of grave importance, and it was desired that all the members be present. It was there I learned that Richard R. Lyman was to be tried for his standing, charged with immoral conduct. The evidence showed that he had been discovered in bed with a woman, not his wife, by officers of the law and certain brethren accompanying them. He confessed his guilt and stated that it had been carried on for 10 years or more, and that he had had similar associations with other women before he was made an apostle. As senior apostle next to the president of the quorum, I felt it was my duty to make the motion for excommunication, which I did between sobs of sorrow. The motion was as follows. I move that Richard R. Lyman be excommunicated from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints for unchristian-like conduct and immoral conduct. The motion was seconded by Joseph Fielding Smith and carried unanimously, Brothers Callis and Benson not present. When the announcement was published in the newspaper, however, they had changed that language. In their weekly reports, other members of the Council of the Twelve recorded their views of the series of events that culminated in Lyman's excommunication. I should also mention that the woman involved was also excommunicated at the same time by the Council of the Twelve. Stephen L. Richards wrote that, quote, on Friday, November 12th, my appointment at St. John's was canceled. Attended the most sorrowful and tragic meeting of the Twelve in the temple where our associate, Richard R. Lyman, was excommunicated. Saturday evening, visited his family and talked with him. The most grievous experience of my ministry. Joseph Fielding Smith reports, for the past several days, from the 2nd of November until Friday the 12th, I was engaged in some special work with Elder Harold B. Lee, which work was assigned to us by the First Presidency in relation to the actions of Elder Richard R. Lyman, which required some investigation. I was present before the Council of the Twelve Friday afternoon when Elder Lyman was brought before that body and tried for his fellowship. Elder Harold B. Lee and I entered the complaint upon which Elder Lyman was charged. Convicted and cast out of the church, which action brought sorrow and mortal pain upon all of the brethren. While there was a great deal of information concerning the meeting in the temple that resulted in Lyman's excommunication, considerably less is known about the relationship that caused this action. Both then and since, there have been a number of theories and a great deal of speculation. I encountered one theory which alleged that Lyman had fathered an illegitimate son, who upon entering military service noted in his records that his father was Richard R. Lyman. According to this theory, the recruiting sergeant, who just happened to be a Mormon and knew that Lyman's only son Wendell was dead, then reported the event to church authorities, and the rest is history. I'm unaware of any evidence that would support that theory. Another theory suggests that Lyman was confronted by the First Presidency in the early 1940s and accused of improper and illicit relations, and that he, Lyman, denied these allegations. According to this theory, J. Reuben Clark, a member of the First Presidency, didn't believe Lyman's protests of innocence and determined to discover the truth. There is some evidence, not direct, but there is some evidence that might support this theory. Several individuals have told me that Lyman did not bear any particular animosity toward his ecclesiastical colleagues, with the exception of J. Reuben Clark. Herbert B. Ma, Utah's governor during the 1940s, for example, who knew Lyman and served with him on the MIA General Board, recalled that Richard R. harbored no resentment toward his former colleagues, with the exception of President Clark. Moreover, as Joseph Fielding Smith's journal indicates, it was Clark who gave Smith and Harold B. Lee the unpleasant assignment, which ultimately led to the apprehension of Lyman. Of course, asserting that Lyman held some sort of a grudge against Clark and attributing that to the belief that Clark exposed Lyman's other life because of his lies at the First Presidency are obviously two different matters. Other theories abound as well. One is that Lyman's downfall really was Amy's fault because of a failure of her to provide for Lyman's physical and sexual needs. This seems to me to be an easy and somewhat predictable explanation. It is true that Amy and Richard were very, very different people. Richard was an outgoing, exuberant man, a flatterer given to flowery language and compliments. Amy Brown Lyman was a strong-willed, forceful, and imposing figure who was considerably more serious and reserved. Moreover, because of her duties as a Relief Society officer, Amy was frequently absent from the Lyman home. Of course, so was Richard as an apostle. It is also true that Lyman acted differently when Amy was around than when she was absent. The late T. Edgar Lyon recalled for me the time that the Lymans visited in Holland, where Lyon was then serving as a mission president. When Amy was present, remembered Lyon, Lyman was much more reserved and businesslike. When she was gone, he was much more expansive. During his tour of the mission in Holland, Lyman would walk to his meetings if they were close when Amy was with him. But when she was gone, Lyman remembered, he would always take the car, no matter the distance, telling me, "I own a car dealership. I make money selling automobiles. So why should I set an example for other people by walking?" It is quite possible that a combination of physical separation, emotional distance, personality differences, and the tensions of two careers pushed the couples apart. There is some evidence to support such a view in Amy's autobiography, where she refers to Richard only twice, once as my husband and the other time as Dr. Lyman. Some observers have suggested that Lyman was jealous of his wife's prominence, which at times exceeded his own. Apparently, Lyman himself encouraged this view by telling the story that following his call to the apostleship, he was riding the trolley car from the university campus downtown when he overheard two men ahead of him reading the newspaper, and one man said to his friend, "Who is this Richard R. Lyman who's just been called as an apostle?" And the other person replied, "Oh, you know him. He's Amy Brown's husband." Was his story harmless self-deprecation or suggestive of a proud and some ways arrogant man who resented being overshadowed by his successful wife? Or did it simply reflect pride in his wife's accomplishment? It's hard to say. At the same time, it is quite apparent that Richard R. Lyman had a strong preoccupation with sex. He talked frequently about the topic, both in private conversation and from the pulpit. And some remember his remarks as embarrassing. Frank Jonas, longtime professor of political science at the University of Utah, recalled for me that Lyman spoke to his student ward when he was attending college. And he said, "While I don't consider myself a prude," he found Lyman's frank discussion of sex inappropriate. Recently, the daughter of a state president of the 1930s told me of an experience in her home when Lyman was the visiting authority. After conversing with her mother about the importance of cooking skills, he inquired of the woman if she and her husband slept in the same room and in the same bed. When the woman replied in the affirmative, Lyman remarked that he was pleased because married couples should always sleep in the same bed. Others remember Lyman's flirtatious manner. He would often say to women he was trying to flatter or impress, "Oh, if I'd only met you before I met Amy Brown." A secretary for the 12 who served when Lyman was an apostle recalled a situation when a female visitor to his office whose expensive perfume and seductive dress combined with what she believed was an improper familiarity between Lyman and his visitor and made her very uncomfortable. As the years passed, there seemed to be a growing uneasiness on the part of some people toward this frank apostle. Joseph Anderson, secretary to the first presidency for a half a century before he became a general authority himself, recalled for me that during a European visit in the 1930s, Heber J. Grant told Anderson that he didn't understand exactly why, but he had some bad feelings toward Lyman, and he felt that something was wrong, something was amiss, and that he felt like he should call Lyman home from his service as president of the European mission. Anderson cautioned Grant not to be hasty and to remove Lyman from his post without any good evidence that he shouldn't be there. Again, T. Edgar Lyon recalled a similar experience. After a visit to Holland, Lyon and his wife, Hermana, dropped Lyman off at his hotel. On their way home, Hermana remarked, "You know, Ed, there's something about Richard R. Lyman that just bothers me. I can't put my finger on it, but there's something about him that makes me think that he isn't the kind of person that a general authority ought to be." Lyon cautioned his wife to be careful here because she was speaking of one of Christ's apostles. Hermana replied she understood all of that, but there was something that gave her a bad feeling about Richard. In retrospect, in hindsight, Lyman actually left some interesting clues himself. In the first conference address he delivered after being named an apostle, he made the following comments. It is new and strange for me to occupy this place. Who am I? Why should I be here? My life and my work and my attention has been directed almost exclusively to educational work. I've not done regular service as a missionary. I do not stand before you, therefore, as a preacher, but merely as a Mormon boy, and all I can do is say a few words in defense of my religion and my people, as I've done during my college life and at other times when separated from you, my people. Some years of my life I've spent in Eastern colleges, and during that time, separated as I was from kindred and the church, I had nearly all the temptations to resist. The teachings of the church and the training of my good Mormon mother gave me strength. I prayed as she taught me to pray. I believed in God and His guidance. I began every day's labor with an expression of gratitude to my Heavenly Father for His guidance. Thus I was able, when surrounded with temptations, to make my life conform with the teachings of the church and live accordingly with the wishes of my excellent parents. Lyman told the congregation that he had, quote, never been sufficiently conceited to think that I deserved to stand in this sacred place that was occupied so recently by my distinguished father. Saying that his deceased father, Francis M. Lyman's heart was aglow with delight, Lyman told his listeners, "My fondest hope is that, as a member of the Council of the Twelve, I may merit in some degree the precious love and friendship that you had for him." Lyman concluded his remarks with a call for God to make us better and happier from day to day. In this personal and introspective initial speech as a general authority, Richard R. Lyman suggests that he viewed his calling to the Twelve as a tribute to his father's memory, not a recognition of his own attributes, nor necessarily evidence of God's will. As I say, in hindsight, several other of Lyman's conference talks include similarly personal and introspective comments. In October 1918, for example, he states, "It was intimated yesterday by one speaker that perhaps all of us are not living in strict conformity with some of the teachings and practices of the church. The reason is that we are clothed upon with mortality. We all have tremendous imperfections. We all have shortcomings and weaknesses to overcome." At the April 1920 conference, Lyman returns to this theme. "Let us struggle on together, remembering that we all have weaknesses. Let us live on, struggle on, and hope that our shortcomings may be overcome, that we may be thoroughly worthy of the blessings promised to the faithful, that the purpose of our Father might be fulfilled, and that they may be fulfilled swiftly." Let's now turn our attention to another important question that I think is raised by the excommunication. Obviously, Lyman's excommunication was a tragic downfall for a respected leader. Lyman, the educated academic, was a champion of the Mormon intelligentsia and one of a number of general authorities drawn from academic ranks in the first few decades of this century. As a church official, he preached reform and open-mindedness from the pulpit, frequently at General Conference itself. He was a firm advocate of the Word of Wisdom, among other things. In many ways, he exemplified and preached to secular Mormonism. I don't mean this to be a pejorative term. Lyman was certainly no theologian. Rather, he talked about secular questions and the importance of applying Mormon values to those concerns. At the same time, Lyman's case raises interesting questions about the nature of revelation, inspiration, and the process whereby general authorities are selected. I've been told that the lore of the Lyman family suggests that few of his family contemporaries thought of Richard R. as a future apostle. Some have suggested that had his older brother, Francis M. Lyman Jr., been in better health, the call would have gone to him. Despite the family's feelings, the brethren who called Lyman believed it was an inspired call. President Anton H. Lund, for example, told Lyman when he was set apart in the temple as an apostle, "You have been selected by and called by the inspiration of the Holy Spirit to our president, and the whole quorum felt joy with the president in sustaining you to occupy this high and very responsible place. In your accepting of this calling, it means that you will devote yourself entirely to the work, that you will allow nothing to intervene between you and the fulfillment of your duty as an apostle." If Lund's assertion, that Lyman was called by inspiration is correct, the obvious question is, why would God inspire a president of the church to call someone to the apostleship who, according to later accounts, had engaged in prior illicit relationships? On this point, the remarks of Joseph F. Smith at the same conference where Lyman was sustained are interesting. Immediately after Lyman had spoken and sat down, Joseph Fielding Smith rose and said, "I do not propose to detain you long, but my mind has been particularly awakened by one or two subjects which I would like to call to your attention. I wish to announce to you and call your attention to the fact that next to the greatest sin and crime that can be committed, that of murder, and from which the penalty is just the same, is the crime of adultery and unchastity. Sometimes we hear rumors or reports from various parts of our country that are heartrending and are awful if they are true. And that is in regard to the lightness in which the principles of chastity are held by some of our young people, and in some respects as lightly passed over by those who ought to be teachers in regard to these principles, and who ought to instill in the hearts of the youth the principles of virtue and chastity." He goes on, "I hope that the Latter-day Saints will hold in mind the fact that there is no greater crime except the crime of murder itself than adultery and unchastity." One can only speculate as to why Smith's mind was, in his words, particularly awakened toward the subject of adultery after Lyman had sat down. Clearly, the words are directed at church members who do not take these principles seriously. It might be that Smith was receiving an insight about Lyman that he simply couldn't understand. It would be difficult, I think, for him or for any other member of the 12 to associate unfitness for the apostleship with the son of Francis M. Lyman, whom they so admired. Or it may simply be a coincidence. There are other questions as well. First, what does the case of Richard R. Lyman suggest about Mormon society and marital mores at the upper level of the church hierarchy? Perhaps it tells us that both then and now, divorce was an unacceptable solution to marital differences. One wonders what might have happened to Amy and Richard's marriage, based on what we know, had he not been an apostle and had she not been general president of the Relief Society. Would they have divorced? Did Amy know of his early associations? Why did they stay married for longer than 20 years after the excommunication? Indeed, they stayed married until Amy's death in 1959 and Richard died 4 years later. Even after an absence of some weeks, it must have been difficult for Amy to return to her Relief Society office. And indeed, she asked David O. McKay to escort her back to work, no doubt as a way of giving the church's vote of confidence to her, even while not condoning her husband's actions. Perhaps after 40 years of sharing the same house, the excommunication really hadn't changed anything. The Lymans simply continued to share the same house, if not a real marital relationship. Perhaps the situation with the Lymans was akin to that of another famous marriage, that of Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt. At some point, they reached an accommodation which would not allow for divorce, but changed very drastically the nature of their marriage. Finally, there is the question of how Lyman's activities relate to the issue of plural marriage. While I am aware of any formal marriage ceremony, apparently Lyman believed that he and the woman who was excommunicated by the 12 with him were, in his words, potential plural partners, whose marriage could not be whose marriage would be formalized in the next life, and that consequently the relationship was not wrong. The practice of Mormon plural marriage has always worked somewhat arbitrarily, depending on 1, the Lord's will, and 2, on prophetic direction and politics of the time. Richard R. Lyman was not the first or only man to justify the love of more than one woman in this way, a justification unavailable to women, however, who happen to love more than one man. For Lyman, perhaps it was a continuation of a commandment. Certainly Lyman could not have missed the fact that both his father and grandfather were polygamists, and that they were honored church leaders, particularly his father. Such a view makes Lyman seem, to me at least, less hypocritical in his actions, and may indeed explain the sense of days that he seemed to find himself in shortly after the excommunication. Moreover, it may explain why Lyman felt he could apply for rebaptism exactly 1 month to the day after his excommunication. In fact, a number of Lyman's actions in the weeks after the excommunication suggest a belief on his part that he would be restored to full fellowship in short order. A former secretary for the Council of the Twelve recalled her amazement when the next week after the excommunication, Lyman came into the office and met with George Albert Smith. And he said while he realized what had happened and he realized that he could no longer function as an would it be possible for him to keep his office at 47 East South Temple? There was a war going on. It was tough to find good office space and good clerical help. And besides, he said, I don't know how to type. Understanding the motivations or the personal actions of any individual is a difficult task. It is no easier trying to understand the nature of a marital or semi-marital relationship. Chronicling such things in a scholarly fashion becomes somewhat subjective, since it is impossible to get inside someone else's head or heart. The excommunication had a dramatic impact on the life and career of Richard R. Lyman, in his family, and on the woman with whom he was associated. Beyond that, it raises important questions about the nature of the Mormon hierarchy. Understanding what really happened and how it was explained inwardly may help us achieve a more balanced and mature view of our society. In that sense, it is a subject with ongoing historical relevance. Thank you.
As you can see, I'm not Marty Bradley. Marty Bradley, in order to preserve the domestic tranquility of her own house, is in the process of moving, and she has written comments. She's an assistant professor at BYU, a PhD in history from the University of Utah, who's written extensively, and especially in the last few years, on fundamentalist Mormon splinter groups. And so I'm going to read her comments, and then we'll have questions from the audience for John. And these are her comments and her words, not mine. My reaction to this paper is at once professional and personal. I cannot separate the two and give a detached, impassioned critique. It presents some interesting questions about the nature of historical inquiry, about historical ethics, and our responsibility in what we do. I suppose I initially reacted to this story by thinking, why are we interested in this? It is so much like National Enquirer sensationalism. The scenario is certainly scandalous in its historical context. The players have star appeal in a way only Mormonism can provide, And the element of tragedy strikes one as being in many ways both profound and enduring. There is a part of me that says this isn't one of the things we should examine, that we should not pick apart personal tragedy and spread it out before the world, that we should let it rest. However, there are some aspects of the story that can help us understand the Mormon experience, that tells us something about ourselves, not just Richard Lyman's mistaken ways. The first idea I'd like to address is my own reluctance to talk about this type of story. I heard a program on KRCL radio about the part stories play in the transmission of values in Native American culture. The commentator said that he thought stories were important because in them behaviors and values are played out. Rather than telling the people what to do, stories illustrate what would happen if they conformed to a behavior or what disaster might fall if they did not. In Mormonism, we are given quite a list of what we should and should not do. Most often, the reason why we should not do something is because Father in Heaven says we shouldn't. In General Conference addresses, stories are recounted about the benefits of service, of tithing, the fruits of sincere prayer, but rarely about the massive and devastating results of adultery. A story like this, played out in all its embarrassing and tragic details, shakes one up like an exhortation never could. The image of a 73-year-old man and his similarly elderly lover caught in the throes of passion in an uncompromising situation is rather stunning. You do not need to spell out the consequences. The concentric circles that spread out from this single event, we can see it, we can feel it. Here a story has the potency that lectures never can. Enough of that. I think the question of how Lyman was called to the 12 and how he stayed connected to the Quorum for so long is more interesting. Certainly Michael Quinn's work on Mormon hierarchy has already shown us that there's a Mormon aristocracy from which the majority of our leaders emerge. Richard Lyman's ascent to the Quorum of the 12 was perfectly in line with many others in the group. Mormons are impressed by lineage. The fact that Lyman was bright, that he was an intellectual, albeit a safe intellectual, that he was smart made him an even more likely candidate for this office. The question of inspiration aside, Lyman was prime material for the Quorum, a logical and solid choice. How he stayed so long is even more intriguing. He obviously contributed much, made many sincere and loyal friends. Perhaps this is another indication of how closely the group guards its own. I remember when the Paul Dunn story finally went public, and Paul Dunn jokes were the meat of every conversation. Someone described the church's attitude in this way: he may be a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch. This might have been their attitude about Lyman as well, that he may be a sinner, but he is our sinner, and we will see him through it. Furthermore, I do think that there is ample evidence that most of the men in the Quorum had no sense of Lyman's transgressions and were surprised by his revelations. I think the descriptions of the meetings of the 12 were very moving. I was struck by how different this scene was from the way we have heard George Lee describe his own excommunication from such different charges. Certainly the level of emotion was profoundly different. I do not think we can second guess why this happened. I teach my students that you can only go with the sources, go with what the sources tell us, let the sources speak. We do not have an account from Amy Brown Lyman of how she felt. We do not know. Since Lyman himself, although living many years after, never explained his own motivation, we will never know. Finally, one of the most interesting issues of all, the position polygamy played in all of this. It is significant that the woman involved in this was a former polygamist, a woman earlier excommunicated in the 1920s for her belief in the practice, although she denied it in part. This certainly says that she was open to a more fluid relationship, that she was accustomed to having part of a man waiting for things to work out in the hereafter. Lyman himself might have been similarly confused by the ambiguous attitude of the church to plural marriage and himself willing to be involved in an unusual connection that might work out some other way. Finally, the thing that strikes me most in this is that this is so ordinary, so human. And again, this is typical of Mormon culture. We would prefer that Lyman had some higher motivation, more complicated reasoning, because he was a general authority. He was an apostle. But perhaps he was, after all, only a man, and a fairly weak man at that, who made mistakes, paid for them publicly, and did so for the rest of his life. That concludes Marty's remarks. John, if it's all right, we have 15 minutes. We'll entertain any questions from the group. I have an obligation to repeat them, and then I'll turn the mic over to you, John. Yes, Ardeen.
Yes, he was rebaptized.
I didn't repeat the question.
The question is, was he ever rebaptized? And indeed, he was rebaptized in the mid-1950s, about 10 years before he died. And I believe had his Aaronic priesthood blessings restored by Mattis Melchizedek.
Yes, sir. Michael Quinn's dissertation at Yale, which was completed in 1976, is a history. I can't remember the exact title, but it's an interlocking, both familial and financial, of the church leaders from, I think the period was 1850 to 1930. Now, a lot of his further research is going to take that up to the present. But it's never been published. You could get it on university microfilms. I think it's in a number of libraries. I mean, it's in BYU's library. He's revising it for publication as a book. But I think in the process, he has 500 pages written and is trying to bring it up to the present. It's about 10 years ago, in the early 1980s. And that's kind of a summary of the thesis. Yes, ma'am. Question is, did they have any children?
Yes, the Lymans had two children, Margaret, daughter Margaret, and a son, Wendell. Wendell was a partner with his father in an automobile business here in Salt Lake and died a tragic death in the 30s.
And Lynn Bennion told me this morning that his daughter Margaret was married to Alexander Schreiner. And yes, ma'am.
Did they
have question is whether or not they had a child that died early as an infant.
Yeah, they did lose a child, and I'm not the one to tell you about this because I haven't studied that part of the life as much as a couple of other people have, but I think she was about maybe a year old or something. It was about 1904. Mm-hmm. Well, I've heard all kinds of stories. Obviously, you hear things that are second or third hand and have no way of verifying them. I don't know whether that's true or not. I've heard other stories. Somebody said to me the other day, oh, yes, Richard R. Lyman, he seduced the widow of so-and-so. And I just said, where do you get these stories? So I don't know much about that period, frankly.
Harold?
Thank you.
Thanks. It continued for more than 10 years. In fact, the only reason he was actually rebaptized is because the relationship was finally ended because he became impotent. It wasn't until that point that they felt that he could be rebaptized. And I think actually that's people say, oh my God, he's 83 years old. And but I think in some ways that's a more valuable comment on all of this than what one might assume. I think it's important to remember that this was indeed a long-term relationship that had endured at some level for nearly 30 years under somewhat adverse conditions, including the fact that obviously couldn't be lived openly, and indeed there were times when Lyman was out of the country for extensive periods of time, etc. But it somehow survived all of that. I think it gives that relationship a little more validity and a little more respect when you look at it in those terms. It also, it makes it seem in some ways a little more scandalous, I guess. I've struggled with trying to figure out how plural marriage fits in all this. At a time or two, Lyman sort of expressed a view that we were a little schizophrenic about plural marriage. And this is, this is 30 years or so, 30 or 40 years after the manifesto. But it was still an issue. There were still stake presidents, some places of the church, who were polygamous. And sometimes they would get the excommunicated, and sometimes they wouldn't. And sometimes it depended on whether or not they were friends with certain authorities who might do the excommunication. And in more than one instance, he sort of asked the question, what's going on here? What is the policy? Is there consistency? How come it was right and now it's wrong, but it's not always wrong? And how do we deal with all this? Somebody mentioned Mike Quinn, and I think Mike believes that some sort of a plural marriage was performed. I have absolutely no evidence of that. And indeed, at the time of the excommunication, apparently, Lyman and the woman involved denied that they were fundamentalists or married plurally, although, as I said, they talked in terms of potential plural partners. The one disagreement I have with Marty's comments, which I think are very good, as is always the case with Marty Bradley, I don't think the woman really knew she was involved in a plural marriage in the early 20s. I think she was honestly telling the truth that when she found out that she was married to somebody who had another wife beside her, that she got very quickly out of that relationship. So I do disagree slightly with that one. So, yeah. The question is, did she die before Amy? And the answer is no, she died a few years after, before Richard did. Mm-hmm. Other questions? Yes, uh-huh. I'm not aware of any evidence that would suggest that. She was actually a seamstress, so I'm not aware of any evidence that would suggest that. Yes. Uh-huh. Well, Amy continued to be general president of the Relief Society for about 18 months after the excommunication when she asked to be released. I don't know. There's a person doing a master's thesis studying Amy Brown's career and probably could answer that better than I. The impression that I get is that by 1945 she'd been in the Relief Society in one capacity or another for more than 30 years, and she felt that was a time to sort of pull back, although she's a very active woman after that. She died in 1959, so 15 years after that, continued to be active in a number of things, literary and civic kinds of things. And indeed, Lyman went on to another career at age 73, got involved in numbering, had been involved in numbering streets early on, and got back involved in that and worked, did this and that. So, yeah. He wasn't charged. In answer to your first question, she was excommunicated at the same time Lyman was, not in absentia, but in fact she was actually there. What happened was they brought them back down to the 47 East South Temple on Thursday, and then they had the meeting the next day on Friday that I alluded to. No, he was never charged with a crime, and in fact, apparently he was not happy that they would do what they did. That he apparently, according to people I've talked to, said there was no need to break in, there was no need to bring the police along. I'd just been with you guys, and you know, what's the big deal? So he was very unhappy about that. The other thing apparently he was very unhappy with was the fact that they published that little announcement in the Deseret News. And he suggested, according to people I've talked to, that that was wrong to do. And that was a source of some controversy between he and his former colleagues. And I think, in fact, that friction made it difficult for Lyman to be rebaptized. And indeed, there are letters in George Albert Smith's papers between 1943 and George Albert Smith's death in 51 in which he is very, very... They're very flattering, almost fawning letters about George Albert Smith, and I think he had a tendency to put some people off by that. So there was real friction, I think, with some of them. Bob?
I understand that the Shriner and Lyman families were very upset when, was it 10 years ago, when President Kimball's biography came out and that whole subject was resurrected in reference to it in President Kimball's journal. I think communication took place just a week after President Kimball had been called. And he was really something for himself and all of a sudden.
We actually have a better authority to answer that than me here. Ed, would
yes.
You like to respond to that? One of the difficulties in all of this is I think that because of this, I don't think Amy Brown Lyman, well, I don't think either Richard R. or Amy Brown Lyman have received their due for the real impact they had on the church. I know Amy hasn't, and I hope that this master's thesis that's being done and some other things might kind of change that. And I don't think Richard has either, really, and maybe I'm a part of the problem, not the solution on this, but I bet I've had a dozen people here at this symposium say to me, I remember the day it happened, you know, it was a tremendous shock. He was the general authority that I most admired. One person told me that he just, every time there was a conference, he just waited for Richard R. Lyman's conference talks because they were always the best. And it was a real, shock. And I think consequently, you go back and read church histories, and indeed even read Richard R. Lyman's obituary, which says, Richard R. Lyman was a member of the Council of the Twelve from 1918 to 1943, and the paragraph, next paragraph, he also was on the board of directors of. I mean, there isn't even a mention. You know, anybody that would know anything about it would say, well, wait a minute, why in the world was he, what happened to that 20-year gap? But it wasn't mentioned. Maybe through the publication of the biography of Spencer Kimball, the biography of Mark Peterson and Harold B. Lee and some other things, maybe we're beginning to accept it as something that happened and talk about it a little more. Yeah. Well, I'd prefer to use the term relationship than affair because it was a long-term relationship. I didn't see any particular evidence of any knowledge of it until right close to the period of time. George or Joseph Fielding Smith's journal, I think, George Albert Smith's journal first mentioned is the 2nd of November. I alluded to the one theory or two I've heard where people have told me, well, no, this is how it really happened. But I don't find any evidence that there was much awareness of it prior to, not too long before the excommunication. How are we doing on time? Okay. Yes. Yeah, we do. Although, I think that because Lyman's excommunication was publicly announced, that I feel comfortable about using his name. Her excommunication was never announced and never published, and so I don't feel comfortable about naming her and won't name her. In fact, it was interesting when she died. Her family came to the funeral, the mortuary, and she was in a regular dress, and they said, "Well, what's going on here? Our aunt," she didn't have children of her own, these were nieces and nephews. "Our aunt had her temple endowments. How come she's not in temple clothing?" And that was the first time that they knew. And the mortician was in a rather uncomfortable position and finally said, "Well, were you not aware that she was excommunicated by the Council of the Twelve?" And they were not aware of that. And it was... I'm not aware of whether she was rebaptized or not. I don't know. But I assume, I just don't know. Good question. Is there time for one more?
One more question.
Okay. Yeah. We don't know a lot about her life, really. And as I say, for a long period of time, she was a seamstress. She was an immigrant woman. Scandinavian immigrant woman, and lived in a totally different world from the Lymans, totally different world. You know, I hear people later say, "Oh yeah, I knew all along there was something happening," and that. And I don't know. I don't know how you verify all that. There are all kinds of stories, and what I've tried to do is stick to just what I can verify. As Marty said in her response, go with the sources. I agree with her on that.
Gene, one more.
I don't know. That's another good question that I don't have the answer for. He did go out and get a job. He went back to LDS Business College and took a typing class and learned how to type. So beyond that, but I don't know. Yeah. Thank you.